Welcome to episode 4 of the Language Neuroscience Podcast. I'm Stephen Wilson, and I'm a neuroscientist at Vanderbilt University Medical Center. This podcast is aimed at an audience of scientists and future scientists who are interested in the neural substrates of speech and language. Thanks for listening. Today, my guest is Jonas Oblisser, who is professor of psychology at the University of Lübeck in Germany. I'm sure there's a different way of pronouncing his name in German, but when I asked in advance, he didn't really give me a straight answer, just made various jokes and told me to call him Oblazer, which I guess would be the Irish form of it. Jonas's lab is called the Auditory Cognition Research Group, and he has a tagline, which is "Sounds and Speech as a Window into the Brain." He studies speech perception, auditory attention, auditory perception and cognition, and he's been doing a lot of translational research looking at hearing loss and aging. A lot of his work involves investigating neural dynamics, such as neural oscillations and entrainment or tracking, and that's what we're going to talk about today. I've been following his work for a long time, and I'm always struck by the intricacy, complexity, and methodological rigor of his studies. To be honest, I have always wanted to understand his work better than I do, and so I thought, this is my chance. Hey Jonas, how are you today?
I'm fine. Thanks, Stephen, for having me.
So just to set the scene, I'm in Nashville, Tennessee. I'm in my front room of my house. I still don't go into work all that often because of the situation. How about yourself?
I'm usually at home as well in Lübeck, Germany, near the Baltic Sea. It's late afternoon here. Today, actually, I did go to my office. There's hardly anybody here. We're all working from home, but my office is like 3 minutes from home, and I'm it's a nice place to get some work done or to record a podcast in quiet. So I decided to do this here today.
So I think we've had the occasional email back and forth over the years, ever since when I was doing my dissertation, which was probably about the time that you were doing your dissertation too. But we really only got to hang out one time, which was when you were a group leader at Max Planck Institute in Leipzig, and I got the chance to visit.
And that was in 2011 or something, right?
Must I think have been it was 12. Something like that. Mm-hmm. I remember we got together and had a few beers, and I met some people from your lab, and that was cool. I've always been really interested in your work, but I want to confess something, which is that I've never understood it terribly well. Because
you're probably not alone with that.
and so one of the reasons why I wanted to do this podcast was to kind of just put myself out of my comfort zone and try and learn new things by getting to talk to people whose work I admire but don't fully understand. And I think one of the reasons why I don't understand your work very well is because, like, I work primarily with hemodynamic imaging, and so I've never been particularly attuned to things that are happening at finer timescales. Whereas your work is all about that.
So you think we basically live we're examples for how anatomists or people who think in the anatomical spatial domain and the people who think in a more temporal domain can't really talk to each other? Is this what we're trying to overcome maybe today here?
Yeah, exactly. I don't want to teach you anything, but I want you to teach. I want to learn.
It's a two-way street. Obviously admired your early work. And I remember that talk actually very well when you came to Leipzig and talked about, I think it involved some lesion work, something that's very, I think, very close to your heart also. And so it's interesting that you think of me as an EEG, MEG, finer, as you said, finer timescale person, because I don't even... think of that myself. I realize that my output is probably nowadays to a large extent dominated by EEG, MEG papers and thinking in this domain. But interesting, because I personally also consider myself a hemodynamic person. How did you call this earlier? I'm happy to I don't know, share whatever you're interested in. Sure.
Cool. Yeah, no, I know. I mean, certainly I know you do imaging fMRI papers as well. It's just that, yeah, those ones I sort of understand. It's the other ones that get me. Mm-hmm. But before we kind of get into that, I just kind of want to get a bit of background about how you became the kind of scientist you are. So you're a professor of psychology now. Is that your title?
That's correct. I'm a professor in a pretty classic if young psychology department, and I'm a trained psychologist. I studied psychology. Although it's interesting that when I started studying, I came from having done some civil service with hearing impaired people, or actually deaf people. So somehow my interest in audition, having been a semi-professional musician, I guess my interest in audition was there, but it somehow got fueled by that time just before I studied. And then I went into psychology as a sort of, I thought of that more as a sort of a backup all around field, psychology. I thought they do all kinds of things and something will interest me, I thought, but I wasn't particularly drawn to it either. Audition or hearing or language or the brain for that matter. But then over the years, I got obviously by those studies in Konstanz, I got very drawn into imaging, if you will, or into MEG actually at the time. And then more by coincidence than anything, around the time I finished my studies, my professor said, Thomas Elbert was that at the time, he was more a sort of at that time, more a plasticity researcher, and he wanted to get into what they called phonemotopic maps, basically. So he wanted to get something done. He had worked on tonotopy a lot, so basically the cochleotopic representation in auditory cortex. They had done fantastic papers on that, or by the time, fantastic papers and interesting work. And then they wanted to do this with vowels or with sounds. So I ended up basically doing my PhD on mapping vowels in auditory cortex using MEG, using N100 source localization. This is how I got. And then I got deeper and deeper drawn into, well, psycholinguistic territory and other levels of speech and language representation. But the vowel was for me as an auditory interested person, an interesting starting point. And I'm very thankful for that. It was an interesting entry into that field.
That's really interesting. So you're saying there were these two pre-existing interests, one being a musician and one having worked with hard of hearing or deaf people. Mm-hmm. And then you kind of came back to those interests after having gotten, I guess, undergrad training in psychology. Is that what you're...
Exactly. Mm-hmm. That's pretty much it. So, and then I did this PhD and early postdoc work in Konstanz on, you know, pretty psycholinguistic topics. We were at the time, I was paid by a linguist, by Aditi Lahiri, who's sort of a phonologist, one should say. And she supported my research at the time. So I was being very loyal, and I think it was only when I really started my own lab that these fully low-level auditory themes came back to the fore end, and I realized I'm not really a psycholinguist. I think at the end of the day, I always said at the time, and I would still think so, that I'm interested in speech and not in language. I always liked that the English language so easily offers us this distinction between those two terms. We don't even have that in German. We could say gesprochene Sprache, which would be spoken language, but we don't have that speech term, which carries these nice phonetic or acoustic and auditory undercurrents. So that's very much where I feel at home these days.
Sure. But, you know, you've definitely got at least a good handful of papers that look at top-down effects on speech perception as well, where you're kind of necessarily delving, you know, putting a foot solidly in the language realm.
That's true. that is true. And that's probably those. Those papers that you mention are like when my lab and I touch upon concepts that others would call clearly linguistic or cognitive, that's probably where I think, I'm interested in the brain and I'm using language or comprehension would be a good term. I'm using that basically as a model to understand brain function. This is also something that's quite dear to me an important point to make maybe early on, that I'm not I really don't think I'm interested that much, honestly, in language. I'm interested in the brain. I consider it a crazy, crazy case of solving a problem to listen or also to represent something like language. But I think if I would have to choose, I would always say I'm a brain scientist or psychologist who's interested in how such crazy tasks are solved, basically.
That's very interesting. Well, you know, you can still be on the Language Neuroscience podcast, even if you disavow any interest in language. And I wish that, you know, our podcast is audio only, so nobody is going to get to see the awesome image that you have behind you, which is mm-hmm. the Smiths in their heyday. Mm-hmm.
At Glastonbury 1984, if you want to Google the image, you should Google Glastonbury 1984 Smiths.
Exactly. Yeah, it's a very beautiful image. Are they one of your favorite bands, or am I just?
I think they are. I think whatever is coming out of my mouth currently, faking as English language, is to a large extent also shaped by Morrissey lyrics. In my late teens, I all of a sudden discovered them, and they, and if you would give me a guitar, which I'm not very good on, but whatever I could sort of fret out would have a Johnny Marr flavor to it. So I think they've been very influential. Yeah.
So when you said you were a musician, what was your what did you do?
I was a drummer mainly, so that's what I sort of learned. So I played drums in a series of soul, funk, independent, ska-like bands in the mid-90s. And learned from the other musicians how to treat those other instruments a bit guitar here and there, or a bit piano. But I was essentially a drummer, yeah.
So who do you like best, Morrissey or Johnny Marr?
That's a tough one. I would think, I think, I don't know. I mean, it's a bit like the yin and yang. I mean, it's exactly the problem that they don't really make for great material separately, I think, honestly. But I think Johnny Marr is definitely the more talented musician, and is probably also maybe more the more, how should you say this? Maybe more an adult person of the two, but nothing without the absolute sort of borderline insanity of Morrissey, of course.
I do agree. When I was a teenager, I had a Dino label maker sticker in my car. It was like a homemade label, and it said, "Marr is a god, Morrissey is a sod." But I absolutely agree with you that without Morrissey, like, it wouldn't have been what it was. And no. You know, when Johnny Marr went and did his other projects later, I mean, there's some okay stuff, but you know, it wasn't the Smiths.
It's not like the old days anymore, as they say, and still ill. Yes.
Yeah. All right. So now that we've covered some of these important topics, one of the themes of your work, as far as I understand it, is kind of like neural oscillations and neural entrainment and the importance mm-hmm. of these concepts for speech perception or mm-hmm. comprehension. So I don't even know if that's a fair framing of the topic, but
I do think that's a fair framing. I mean, that's certainly something that I have been very interested in for, I don't know, I would think maybe about 10 years or so. This all starts at a time when I was in Leipzig and had back EEG under my belt. So coming from London, coming from fMRI work with Sophie Scott, who was also a guest on your podcast, I think, being back in Leipzig and realizing, hey, we have all the EEG here, and hey, I had been trained as an EEG MEG person. So and I sort of rediscovered that temporal domain that you talked about in the beginning. So around that time, and my friend Nathan Weiss, whom I did my PhD with, but sort of we were more friends hanging out, we got in touch science-wise at the time. So around 2008, 2009, I thought I want to do something for the topics I was interested in very much at the time, which was speech and speech degradation. I thought there must be something in this EEG signal. There must be more than an evoked potential, so to speak. So I at the time and still to the day, I'm sometimes thinking of evoked potentials as, I mean, really clever, but ultimately very simple readouts of brain activity. You send something to the brain and the brain gives you sort of an impulse back and says, yes, thank you. And it might say this, yes, thank you, in various ways with various little deflections, but it was a very simplistic and at the time also a bit sort of well-trodden concept. And neural oscillations at the time, to be perfectly frank with you, was just a very exciting topic at the time. And so about 10 years ago, it really sort of lifted off, I think. Again, also neural oscillations as an idea, the idea that the human brain is is expressing itself to us almost, if I say so, in oscillations, in rhythmic activities, also a very old observation. But at the time, things came together. So in my hands, in my lab, I wanted to use that. And I quite naively started out with, basically, I think we started where you start where the light is when you're looking for something. And in the human brain, the light is clearly in the alpha range. The alpha oscillations, even you as a non-EEG person have a sort of a vague idea about alpha oscillations, right? I mean, Hans Berger, about 100 years ago, they are so prominent, you can see them with the raw eye. So it's always good to start somewhere where you have a good signal to noise ratio. Okay. And that's so, and to this day, I think that alpha oscillations are a really, really interesting little creature, or actually more like a monster. But my understanding at the time was a very naive one. I thought we could easily, the speech, it has rhythm, or some people say so, and there's the brain, this has also rhythm, so they should team up nicely, and maybe speech comprehension. I'm exaggerating, of course, but only slightly. At the time, this was maybe all our thinking of it, like, oh wow, if they match up, then you have comprehension or something, right?
Right.
And things got really, really complicated from there, and I don't know how much has really been solved since then, so, to be honest.
So just, you know, just yeah, in case sorry. Any of, what is the frequency range of alpha oscillations?
Right. So the field has agreed on calling these, calling brain activity that is rhythmic and cycles in this orderly fashion between, say, 8 cycles per second to about maybe 12, 13 cycles per second. So 8 to 12 was always the thing. So I'm saying cycles per second, but it's of course hertz, okay, as we came to know it. So
what do you think about
the rhythm? This is actually, it's important because it's true to this day that, and now, for example, by beautiful work from Brad Wojtek and others in San Diego, we have a good technical repertoire to show which frequencies in the brain are actually oscillatory. So where is really rhythmicity? And it's a fact that in the human from the human scalp, if you record activity, this activity in the alpha range, so between say 8 and 13 hertz, this is really rhythmic. So it's lifted up, it peaks out of this typical frequency spectrum of brain activity. It really peaks out as an oscillation. So by all accounts, I think everybody would agree that alpha activity is oscillatory, which is not true for other things that people claim to be neural oscillations. It has shifted. People nowadays, if they want to study neural oscillations or want to make a case for the cognitive involvement or the involvement of neural oscillations in a cognitive process, this has shifted that they first have to show that they're actually talking about oscillatory activity, right?
Right. Do you have any idea why the brain oscillates at 8 to 12 hertz?
I'm not in a very good position to tell you this. I should say I'm as much as I'm interested in alpha oscillations, I'm not the best expert when it comes to I'm not a biophysicist by any means who has enough understanding of the biophysics or how oscillations are generated. I think it's pretty clear that it's not just a local phenomenon, but so partly in tune with this frequency. So this frequency being by comparison in the brain, a sort of, I don't know, a slow or middle range frequency, which also means it involves probably distances that are sort of middle range. So you I wouldn't think of alpha as sort of the long haul frequency, but maybe sort of you have maybe circuits involving certain cortical regions and the thalamus being actually it's an old idea going back many decades that the thalamus is involved in generating those rhythms. And I think this is an idea that has also gained new prominence, partly through work, for example, the cognitive domain that people like Sabine Kastner have done a few years back, 10 years ago, Salman Kastner, where they showed that alpha and also the more cognitive aspects of alpha in attention, for example, seem to involve the thalamus. So probably we're talking about loops that are not strictly local. So it's maybe unlike some fast gamma acting activity. So gamma, maybe, I don't know, let's say, for example, in the 70, 80 hertz range, uh-huh. or even higher, even the work, maybe you had Eddie Chang on the podcast recently. If they record this high frequency gamma activity quite locally from a certain region, then they can probably be also pretty sure that it's mostly this local cortical area that produces that signal. And that's probably very different for slower frequencies like alpha.
Right. Okay, cool. So thanks for that. So before I kind of distracted us by asking about those sort of basic definition things, you were going to sort of say that you were talking about how initially you had thought there might be a fairly straightforward correspondence right. between the alpha rhythm and the rhythms of speech.
Exactly, or exactly not for the alpha rhythm. I think this was pretty clear pretty early on. I mean, David Purple and many other colleagues, but he was probably at the forefront of this, have made early on a case, which is it starts as an acoustic observation to say that human speech, like you and I talking here to each other, involves a lot of so-called theta activity. Now, calling this theta is denoting frequencies maybe between 4 and 8 hertz traditionally, so 4 to 8 events per second, is of course, I mean, that's for one, that would just be an observation that our, that I'm opening and closing my jaw now at such frequencies that dominating the spectrum, the acoustic spectrum of what I'm producing here. So the interest shifted to theta, and it still is for all things related to speech and language. We're talking about frequencies in the theta and delta range. So delta is even below that. So I broadly think of the speech relevant frequency range somewhere between 1 and 8 hertz. So for people more linguistically inclined, they might immediately think, and it's this parallel that people make between the acoustics and the brain that is so alluring, and but that's also probably misleading us sometimes. But you think immediately of slow prosodic intonation processes mm-hmm. in your language, and you have these faster syllables. So the obvious questions are, where in the brain activity do I find signatures of the brain tracking what somebody else is saying? So tracking is a very charged and loaded term, but that's a term we're using a lot, right? We're thinking of, when you listen to me, is your brain sort of using that register or its own endogenous activity in that frequency range, in the delta theta range, to reorganize? Wouldn't it be clever if you happen to have endogenous delta theta oscillations ongoing for whatever reason? Mm-hmm. Wouldn't it be very clever if you would bring those oscillations in sync with the stuff I'm providing you with? Basically, yep. I mean, the logic is very simple. If we think of an oscillation as indicating a change between a state of relative excitation, so relative ease of neural communication, and then a state of relative inhibition where it's relatively hard to do anything to that piece of cortex because it's inhibited, broadly speaking. Right. Then, of course, having those excitatory elements in phase, so in sync, well lined up with the interesting bits in speech and language, that would be cool, wouldn't it? And that's where the problems start. I think this far, everybody would agree, I hope, that this would be the idea and this would be cool, but how this is supposed to work and how effective it is and whether and how much of the evidence we're actually already having that this is how comprehension works.
Yeah, it seems
the harder question.
Yeah, I mean, it seems logical up to a point, but I'll tell you the thing that I've never understood, right? And it might be just naive, or maybe it's a good question, I don't know. But you know, a rhythm is rhythmic, right? It's like, you know, absolutely, you know, you're a drummer. I mean, it's like every single beat is going to, if it's 4 hertz, it's going to be 4 per second. It's not going to be like randomly shifting between 3 and 5, or you'd probably get kicked out of whatever band you're in, exactly. ska or otherwise. But even the most rhythmic language, I don't think has that level of rhythmicity, right? Even though there's a beat, it's not like unless you're like actually rapping or deliberately doing that.
And that's a problem for that.
Yeah. So, like, how useful is it really to
for
be
that kind of theory?
How useful is it to be predicting where the next beat's going to fall when it's? Can you really make good predictions?
People have very different would have very different answers to that. I must say I don't want to duck away from that question, but I have to sort of to some level because I totally agree with that. I think this is a problem, especially for everybody who moves beyond the syllable into the more complex linguistic domain. So my friend Lars Meyer, for example, in Leipzig is very, and I admire him for that. He's very invested in thinking how neural oscillations can support more complex phrase structure parsing, for example. And so I think one potential answer to your absolutely correct observation that it's not that rhythmic is, of course, you to say, well, okay, if there is an endogenous oscillation, then that oscillation is rhythmic. Mm-hmm. So what would not work is sort of a perfect lining up that I talked about earlier, because that's by definition then actually not entrainment, because this external signal is not really rhythmic. I mean, if you look up the definition of phase synchrony or sort of synchronization or entrainment in any proper physics textbook, you will find that it requires two oscillators to sort of get in phase with each other.
Right.
And we're having a very obvious problem here already with this external part. So what could still be interesting is to say you measure, you use endogenous oscillations as a sort of a measuring stick. You cannot force everything into this excitable 200 milliseconds of your delta phase or something, but maybe it's helpful to organize it nevertheless. You could think of, uh-huh. of delta oscillations nevertheless as an internal click track or something, right. You know.
Okay.
So, and I think this is more alluring, but it's also, I mean, it's probably what Popper or somebody would call an auxiliary hypothesis, right? Or Lakatosh. We're already gluing something on. We have to extend the framework already because it's obviously not so simple. We have to continue it. But that is true. And for example, my former postdoc, Molly Henry, who's now a great and imaginative researcher on her own in Frankfurt, she's from a rhythmic perspective interested in those kind of things also. Because you mentioned music, I will now mention a study by her where the actual beats you're provided with are very sort of non-rhythmic in a strict sense, but there's still a groove. There's an underlying groove. So basically, you shift the beats around a bit.
Mm-hmm.
But so still, there is an underlying meter. Basically, the music people would think. So when we come to language and neural oscillations, maybe the meter, so a bit of a slow-paced marker that you're using, could still be something that slow oscillations can provide. On some level. But so again, we're already trying to save the strict neural oscillations hypothesis. And I do think it has severe problems, which is partly why I'm a bit disenchanted with it. So I don't think that that we can say this is how language comprehension works. I do think that neural oscillations might have an auxiliary supporting role in sort of achieving the robustness of language comprehension, but I don't think it can hardly be the be all end all mechanism.
Right, it sort of doesn't have enough degrees of freedom in one, you know, yeah. Does it?
And also just the sheer, you know, when we talk hard science at the end of the day, the sheer effect sizes. The way where we can find those phenomena, we can find them in near threshold psychophysics experiments, etc. So it's and I love near threshold psychophysics experiments, don't get me wrong, but we're obviously going after phenomena that are rather ephemeral in a way. It's kind of you have to work hard to get at them, and that's usually not something that is sort of that's it's not the low hanging fruit, obviously,
right,
in language research.
So in your recent TICS paper, you mm-hmm. distinguished in a very clear way that I found really helpful between neural oscillations and neural entrainment, these concepts that often seem to blend together.
Yeah, sorry for interrupting, but go ahead. Sorry, maybe I interrupted you early.
I was just going to ask you to kind of like expand on that distinction or kind of explain that distinction.
Right. So I think we've set maybe the stage already for that a bit, because this paper that Christoph Kaiser and I wrote about a bit more than a year ago on this topic was attempted to make this very clear. What is neural entrainment? And we, for that, also suggested to call this entrainment in the narrow sense. So when you have an oscillator that changes its phase relation to an external rhythm in order to sort of be in sync, then this is strictly speaking entrainment. And we do think that there's not too much evidence for this being in place. And partly it's because it's incredibly hard to prove in your little study that you're doing that you have observed neural entrainment. However, there is a lot of interesting work ongoing and has been ongoing for the last 5, 6, 10 years that comes from this kind of angle of saying his speech, his ongoing environmental stimuli like speech, and here is brain activity. And look, they are correlated. And I can learn something about the brain by looking at this correlation. For example, by seeing in which areas, under which conditions, one signal gets, and here's the word, gets tracked more strongly than another one. And what occurred to me over the years after I really struggled with this entrainment concept and find it really dissatisfying that it's so hard to prove. Yep. And then I realized then I had this weird phase for many years where I grumpily, in every review I wrote, sort of grumpily complained about this not being entrainment. And I know that many other people also did this. And sometimes you, as an author, you write entrainment, and as a reviewer, you complain about it. So there was a problem. And so what we tried to say is, okay, I mean, you call it entrainment if you like, but it's entrainment, if at all, in the broad sense. So you have some features of entrainment in your study, and these features, which we define in the TICS papers, are probably more, it's probably cleaner to call it tracking. There's something in the brain response that responds to something in the stimulus in a sort of, you know, correlated fashion. Mm-hmm. So you have a readout. And this could be, for example, the strength of some gamma band activity or something. But what it frees you and me from having that utterly academic discussion over whether this is a true neural oscillation or something. So neural tracking as a tool is incredibly helpful to study, I don't know, all kinds of phenomena, particularly attention and attentive listening, but probably also to study patients or subjects like infants who are not very good at giving us behavioral data. I think it's a great readout. It's fantastic to have it, but it's not necessarily neural entrainment in the narrow sense.
I think that's so helpful, just to kind of think about the different ways in which, kind of relatively high temporal resolution brain activity can be associated with language and what it means, mm-hmm. or speech, whatever you want to call it. And so I think that brings us to the paper that we talked about in, over email before we met today. I wanted to kind of explore one of your papers in more depth, kind of just as a way of getting into seeing what this kind of work looks like on the ground. Mm-hmm. And we picked a paper that's first authored by Sarah Tune. It's currently a preprint, as far as I... Is that where
it's in revision at an undisclosed journal? So I'm sitting here pressing thumbs while we work on a revised version of this. Yeah, but the public is invited to access this as a preprint currently. Yes.
Okay, so I'll link the preprint in the podcast notes if anyone wants to read the paper. I enjoyed reading it. I'm going to kind of summarize it from my perspective, and then kind of just ask you to kind of walk us through the paper and the ideas in it. Sound good?
ambitious, but yes, let's give it a shot.
Okay, so the premise for this paper is that successful speech comprehension relies on filtering of relevant and irrelevant auditory inputs. So I think it's kind of a bit of, it's about things like the cocktail party problem, but more generally, perception of speech and noise. And of course, speech and noise is normal speech perception. It's very rare that we actually get the chance to have
an unencumbered conversation.
So you and your colleagues explain that there are two filter mechanisms that have been studied essentially independently, and you're going to compare them directly for the first time in a relatively naturalistic context. And these two filtering mechanisms that have been discussed in the literature, one of them is lateralization of alpha power. The other is what you call in this paper neural tracking of speech, which is also often called entrainment. So
exactly, but in the sense of this TICS paper that we just talked about, just for clarity, this would be basically neural entrainment in the broad sense. So I would personally refrain from calling it entrainment. We call it also in the TICS paper neural tracking.
And I think in this paper you always call it neural tracking. Mm-hmm. So can you help our listeners and me understand these two different mechanisms? So the first one, lateralization of alpha power. What do we know about that?
Right. So it's maybe it's nice that we talk about this now because we've touched upon both of those mechanisms in a way.
Yep.
We talked about alpha oscillations briefly in the beginning. And so alpha oscillations had been around for a long, long time, essentially the first observation ever, hence the name also, for almost 100 years now. But it's been only like 15, 20 years ago that Wolfgang Klimisch and particularly Ole Jensen have made an important contribution by giving us a testable framework for what alpha oscillations might actually be useful for on a more cognitive or one might even say practical level. And the idea here is that it's a parsimonious idea. It's oversimplified, but it's extremely helpful in weeding through the evidence out there. The idea is that alpha oscillations, when expressed locally in a piece of cortex somewhere, or for example over a large part of the left or the right parietal cortex, might indicate a basically inhibition. Ole Jensen called it functional inhibition, but this morning I thought, well, every inhibition is, maybe some reviewer made him do it. I don't know. Every inhibition is functional, I hope, on some level. But so the idea is that, so the framework is called functional inhibition. And so what showed up pretty quickly in that research long before us, but what we're using here is that spatial attention, so your amazing ability to focus on some part of your environment and ignoring other chunks of that basically the other hemifield, to keep it simple, is accompanied, and mind the non-causal language I'm using now, is accompanied by a lateralized alpha activity. Basically, broadly speaking, we all know roughly the visual system. If you have contralateral input, so you expect that hemisphere contralateral to a hemifield to be particularly involved in processing that input.
Yep.
And so this is actually where you would have relatively decreased alpha power. When you're actively attending there, you're not all in line with this idea of a lot of information can flow in, can get processed locally. And in the other hemisphere, so in the ipsilateral hemisphere, you have strong alpha, relatively enhancement of alpha power. So what my lab has been doing for these last 10 years, ever since we got busy on alpha, is to say, how could this work in speech? And and we're not the only ones, of course, to have seen that this idea of alpha lateralization works pretty well in all kinds of sensory domains. It works for somatosensory, it works for vision, but it also works for audition. And in audition, it's a bit more tricky because the alpha activity you're seeing is not strictly auditory. It involves the STG, so the superior temporal gyrus, the posterior parts, but it also is always usually working in concert with parietal cortex.
Yeah.
So I call it a neural filter mechanism because I think of it as something. So on a psychological level, you have attention that you want to implement. You want to achieve a goal of attending, favorably to one side. And we're thinking of alpha as one potential filtering mechanism helping you to do that. So that's one thing. Nice. But is it really doing that in a large sample as we have here, 150 people? and even on single trials, can I use that alpha signal, that alpha lateralization that I can pretty reliably measure in EEG, but can I use it to predict whether or not you will perform sort of adequately in that very trial? And that was the question we were after here.
Okay.
And that's what we pitted against neural tracking as the other proposed mechanism, more coming from the speech and auditory domain, more used by colleagues who are interested in building brain-computer interfaces. So the idea more akin to the work by Eddie Chang and others, and Nima Mascarani, to say, whenever you're listening to one competing track against another and you try to ignore that other track, this processing, this prioritized processing should yield or should be accompanied by, or some people might even say, is caused by better tracking of that speech part, basically. Yeah. So that's the idea. And we took that to, we wanted to build one experiment where all of this is in there, where we can do nice alpha lateralization, then present sentences onto the left and right ears so we can get nice neural tracking. And then we get a behavioral readout to see whether this worked for you. And we give you some Posner-like cues up front to tell you, listen to the left or listen to the right or listen to, we don't know either. And then there were also some semantic cues, which our linguist friends would be more interested in, but which only make a cameo in this paper, I should say.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, we could almost skip talking about the semantic cues just to keep it kind of,
yes,
keep it clearer. Because I think
the data will all be open source and the data will all be out there. And I hope that generations to come find interest in those data and can do something with the semantic cues.
Maybe they can glean something there, because it wasn't that clear in your analyses that there was.
Yeah.
So just to kind of recap, because again, I'm communicating about experiments in the auditory modality only, I think is very challenging. And so I'm just trying to find ways of doing that. So we've got these two filtering mechanisms. One is lateralization of alpha power. And the way that it plays out in the auditory context is if you're attending to the right ear, which is somewhat favoring the left hemisphere, although the auditory system is hardly completely crossed, you would expect attenuation of alpha power in the left hemisphere if you're attending to the right ear and vice versa. And that's one possible filtering mechanism for attention. The other is neural tracking or having the, you know, any kind of signal, whether it's high gamma or anything else, kind of resembling the envelope of the speech.
Exactly. And this resembling aspect is actually like we do this by actually testing for resemblance. So we basically correlate a predicted or in this sense, a reconstructed speech envelope with the played speech envelope. That's really, so resembling is a good word here. It's exactly what's happening.
Okay. So yes. So then the structure of the trials, you've got like a lot of participants. I think you've got over 150, various, ages and various hearing statuses.
Mm-hmm.
And they listen to sentences. They listen to two simultaneous sentences, one to each ear, and before the sentences, they're given a cue to either attend left, attend right, or they're given an uninformative cue, and then eventually they have to detect a word in the right ear sentence or the left ear sentence, which either matches the cue, but if there wasn't a cue, then they don't know which one they're going to
have. They're a bit left guessing, because then later, like again, a jittered period later, a few seconds later, there's this prompt, basically there's this probe. They have four words on the screen and they have to pick the word. And we basically, if you had this, if you didn't have a very informative cue up front where to listen, so what you do is you probably try to wing it and you sort of divide your attention, however that's possible, and try to take in both of those sentences and somehow, and then see when you don't know yet whether we will be asking about the word that the left sentence ended in or the word the right sentence ended in. Exactly.
Exactly. And so this kind of gives you the setup that you need to look at attention to one sentence, attention to the other sentence, divided attention. Okay. You can look at success, you can look at reaction time, and you can look at these neural measures of lateralization of alpha power as well as neural tracking.
Exactly. And the fans might recognize somewhere in there, we're going a bit overboard, but we like to call it a sort of a linguistic Posner paradigm. So the psychologist might recognize this flavor of some elements of a classic attention Posner task, where you basically cue to one hemifield. And so this is what we're trying to do here also. Yeah.
Yes,
that's
definitely.
Actually, that's there for the alpha, because this whole idea of functional inhibition, alpha filtering should be beautifully in place, and actually is beautifully in place after the cue. So while you're preparing for what's coming, that's when these alpha filters, may I call them this way, when these alpha filters are basically set up, see beautiful alpha lateralization.
So behaviorally, did you get the effects you were expecting from the cues in terms of their effects on accuracy and reaction time?
Yeah, they're totally behaving the way we were expecting them. So a valid, and this is almost like a sanity check in this kind of paradigm, that a valid spatial cue to say, hey, attend to the left, gives you, or attend to the right for that matter, gives you better performance. So you're more likely to get it right on that trial. And you're also faster. And the interesting part, if I'm already might say something about results here, but the interesting part here really is that older participants, so we were very interested in attention is still this contentious thing, whether older people or part of the problems that older listeners have results from a cognitive attention implementation problem. So basically, are they maybe not able to use such a cue the way you and I, or for that matter, a 20-year-old.
Are we young people for these purposes?
We are in this study because we started at 40, but we're not in terms of any other undergrad study you're normally doing, right?
Right.
So that's a good point. No, so in that sense, it was interesting to see that this is largely, by and large, preserved function and was pretty independent of age, and that worked well. Yeah, so that's important for this whole study because, I mean, if here would be already a problem, then you could say, yeah, well, the whole attention setup was a bit weird. And since it was a new study, you want to have those basic effects in place. And I think they're there.
Certainly, yeah. You got the behavioral effect. And then how about, were you able to induce lateralized alpha power the way you were hoping?
Yeah.
With your cues?
Beautifully so, I think. So in this study, if you look up the paper, you could look at figure 3 if you're interested in that, but you would see an alpha power lateralization. Basically, as the cue comes on, the cue is a symbolic cue, but it tells you you've learned over a few trials that this means, they will ask me about the left sentence in a second. You see this alpha lateralization in the expected direction. Yeah. So you see this is set up quite neatly. It then breaks down again because we had the audacity of also showing this other cue that we don't want to talk about, the semantic cue. So that breaks a bit, but it's interesting because it seems to break this, the whatever you so it's interesting because it links its circumstantial evidence linking alpha lateralization to these sort of behavioral goals. You want to listen to the left, or yeah, let's say to the left for a second. So you bring down your right alpha already in preparation. And then when something else happens, this might go away. And then when the actual sentence comes on, this lateralization is reinstated. So it's not as strong. And that makes sense because bottom up, we're driving the system with left and right input. So we're making it, if you think of it really, really as a top-down filter, then we're making it hard for this top-down filter to operate because we're pushing with equal volume essentially into both channels, right? But then towards the end, so this, I find this really fascinating because the subjects seem really, really good. They've learned those tasks at those trials over hundreds of trials. When you average, they know where the money is, that in the end of the sentence, that's when you see beautifully how alpha lateralization increases and reaches actually or extends, so exceeds the levels that we had in the cue phase. So it's really, I think that works. That's all almost, I would think, in my little world, textbook-like alpha lateralization. So that's cool.
Yeah, just to recap that temporal pattern, mm-hmm. which I found really striking too when I looked mm-hmm. at the figures, it's like the cue induces alpha suppression in the expected hemisphere, but then, as you said, it goes away for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. And it comes back in the sentence, but it especially comes back when you get to the final word, mm-hmm. which is the one that they're going to have to report on. So it's mm-hmm. like they are allocating their attention as desired, but in a very strategic way. They're not just kind of only attending right. to that one hemisphere.
Exactly. So my colleague Malte Wüstmann and I, we tend to call this a spatio-temporal filter currently. We think of alpha as really something that helps you whether it helps you is the other big question that we might be getting to in a minute. But it's obviously telling us as researchers something about what the listener intends to do with her attentional resources, where and when she wants to deploy them. I think this can be nicely read off alpha lateralization. Yes.
Cool. And so how about neural tracking? You sort of started to answer this already, but I guess two-part question. Like, firstly, how do you measure neural tracking? And secondly, did you see the neural tracking hemispheric differences that you anticipated?
So neural tracking, again, is when you think of the math behind it, you're wondering why it took so long for it to really become a household technique. It's really due to colleagues like Jonathan Simon from Maryland or Ed Laylor from Dublin or now Rochester, who have championed this technique for us. But it's essentially just what you do is you correlate, in plain terms, you correlate a signal of interest, for example, the broadband envelope or some form of acoustic representation of what you play to your subject with the ongoing raw EEG signal or MEG signal. And by doing so, you basically, it's just like a little regression problem you're solving. So you end up with a regression weight. But now the little trick is that you do this in a time shifted fashion. So it's essentially, to be fair, it's a technique called reverse correlation in the single cell spiking literature. It's been around for much longer. The original paper is probably from around 1970, where the term reverse correlation was used for the first time. So, uh-huh. so you come up with basically a time shifted regression, and this gives you a little kernel. It's also to be seen in many of those figures. It looks like an ERP. When you're not from our field, you think like, what is this? This looks like a typical waveform. They've been showing this for 40 years, uh-huh. But the difference is that this is now gained from a little mathematical trick done to essentially ongoing speech materials. And this is the breakthrough element, I think, for our field, for psycholinguistics, right? That you don't have to, also, if you want to take what we're doing here and apply it to much more interesting linguistic questions, like people are beginning to do now, people are beginning to mm-hmm. study phonetics, studying phonology, studying semantic representation with those very same techniques, that you use some features in your signal to basically see how it's been encoded in the brain signal and by estimating these responses. And anyway, a long story short, when you have these kernels or response functions, you can easily take a new trial. You can also call it machine learning if you're into those kind of terms. It's also machine learning because you uh-huh. now take a single trial that Sarah has sort of put aside during the analysis, and she takes that trial now and says, look, with your little estimated fancy kernel, what do you think? Was this the attended sentence we played, or was it the ignored sentence? And then the decoder says, I think it's rather, you know, it rather looks like this one. So it probably this was the attended one because this is stronger. So you're playing these little decoder games there. And mm-hmm. we're then basically saying, okay, we call we think that the listener attended to that sentence where we can just a tad bit better reconstruct the envelope, also basically the audio. And uh-huh. To make this short, yes, it worked the same way. You basically get better. So you can basically show with that technique, again, that listeners follow your instructions. That's what you find out here. Basically, you tell them to attend left, and in those trials, there you also get better reconstruction accuracy. So that works. So I think both measures are neatly in place. And yes, you can say to that point, both filtering mechanisms are in place and work fine also in older age. And they, they're well behaved in that sense.
Okay. So yeah, they followed the rules and they did what they were supposed to. They performed as expected. You saw the neural evidence for both kinds of filters. Mm-hmm. Which filters And but you know, they weren't perfect on every trial, right? So accuracy varied. Sometimes they get it wrong, and also reaction time varied. So maybe the central question of the paper was, you know, which of the two filters or both are going to actually predict trial by trial performance, or maybe individual differences in participant performance. What did you find? What did you find there?
Well, yeah, if I may, before I cut to the behavior, the thing is, those filters could also be, and I think some colleagues might have well thought so, they could also be very closely related. They could be just basically different sides, different sides of the same coin or something, or the same metal. I didn't think so. I do think that the whole dynamics and the whole generation of those are very, very different. But I was actually expecting, to be very plain honest here, and we show this in some of the graphs, we were thinking that alpha power, as it's also present earlier, it's already present before the audio starts, is sort of implementing a filter. So if you are either as a person or in a given moment implementing a strong alpha filter, it should also be predictive of how strongly your neural tracking works.
Yep.
So that was, the to me, a big surprise, actually challenging a lot of my thinking over the last years and challenging the thinking that went into the funding for this very paper, that these are pretty unrelated. And so with having Sarah as a colleague, very, very statistically, very well versed and pushing really these statistical analyses on the single trial level, we could convince ourselves that those are pretty unrelated. If at all, there is sort of a time-lagged relationship between them. But for now, let's say they're surprisingly unrelated. So you could think of them, which is also nice because you can think of them as two independent ways of implementing auditory attention. Uh-huh. And now when it comes to predicting whether or not you get a trial correct, it turns out that alpha is, and this might be a letdown for some people, it was for me in a way, but that's science. Alpha is surprisingly unhelpful in predicting whether or not that works.
So yeah, I would have assumed that was an unexpected finding, right?
Sorry?
I would have assumed that was an unexpected finding.
It was an unexpected finding before the whole project started. So if this would have been a pre-registered study, you would now read in the pre-registered hypotheses, alpha should predict basically the degree of alpha lateralization just prior to the trial or during the trial should be predictive of how strongly this is. And I want to turn this around though and really say, if you're an alpha researcher, I do think those are the kinds of analyses you have to show before you call your papers alpha supports, alpha does XY to attention or something. Because I think by all accounts, we measured the behavioral readout of attention, I think, and we've been unsuccessful to show that alpha is, in that sense, causally important. So having a strong or a less strong alpha filter, it might be nice to have a nice strong alpha lateralization, and it might tell us a lot about the way you deploy attention, but it's not directly related to whether or not you will succeed on that trial. So, and that is an interesting lesson for me.
Yeah. And
neural tracking does it.
Quite surprising. Neural tracking.
Neural tracking does it. It works. We've tried a lot of things. We think
so. I guess you're saying is neural tracking was predictive of behavioral performance, accuracy, and reaction time.
So the stronger, to say this in one plain sentence, the stronger your neural tracking index, that means the relative neural tracking being stronger for attended, so if we're really better able to reconstruct your attended speech, attended envelope compared to the ignored envelope, if this distinction is cleaner while you listen to the sentence, then you're also more likely to get it correct and you're faster in doing so. So for both classic behavioral readouts, the accuracy and the speed, your neural tracking is predictive. So I think this is an interesting finding that when pitting those two, and I should mention, a lot of colleagues have been skeptical about our neural tracking because we're maybe among the first to try this in a very short, in a typical trial paradigm. Normally, speech tracking is currently done on audiobooks. It's fantastic. You have these long stories, a lot of data. And we tried to push it down to a more simple alpha-like trial structure. And still, we got 1.5 seconds or 2 seconds to work with for the neural tracking analysis. And so it might well be that we're underestimating a bit the power of neural tracking, the explanatory power, I think, because our neural tracking per se is maybe a bit more noisy than what you would get if you would listen for longer. But so, yeah, I think that's where the money is right now, that those two filters are there, but the ascribing causal meaning to them in the sense of, are you really needed to get behavior, to mm-hmm. get your cocktail party going? I don't know. That's so less clear after that. And I think we have the power with 160 people of varying age, of the interesting age, the cocktail party age, where it's supposed to get difficult. Uh-huh. And A, they're doing fine. And B, the neural tracking seems also in place. Yeah.
Yeah. So I feel kind of excited that I actually read and understood an EEG paper. It doesn't happen very often. Did I kind of ask you did we get to all the critical things that you would want to share as the most important aspects of your findings, or is there anything that we missed?
I think so. I think you did good justice. Thanks for highlighting that work. I should really say Sarah Toon is a fantastic psycholinguist, experimenter, and statistician by now. And I'm very happy to have her and Mohsen here as co-authors, who actually, shouldered all the work in this. What you're seeing here is the work of a basically 5-year European Research Council consolidator grant that is now coming to a close. And so these are now the papers coming out from that. And we're satisfied with having those data because it's I think the sample is big enough and the questions have been principled enough to help maybe settle now and in the future a few points of contention.
Yeah. Well, I thought the paper was really well written. I mean, I think it's a testament to, you and your co-authors that from outside of this field, I was able to understand it and kind of follow along with, getting to, what the questions were and how the data answered the questions. And we left out a lot of detail in our discussion because just for practical purposes. But yeah, there's even more in there. Okay, so that was great. There's just one other thing I wouldn't want to let you go without touching upon. Your interest in, let's say, the aesthetics of science. I know that you are the person that I follow on Twitter who is most likely to complain about something like one line of a paragraph going on to the next page in a manuscript draft or something like that.
Orphan headings.
Yeah. And I really share that, although I don't share it with the world like you do. So I guess tell me in 2021, what does your ideal manuscript format look like for a submission?
Ah, that's so interesting that you ask that. Thanks for bringing that up. I don't have an answer, but I just love airtime for typography. I think there should be more airtime for it. I don't know whether I'm not a big podcast follower, so maybe there are lots of podcasts on that. But anyway, I do think that a scientist's mind is expressed on some level in some twisted way in the copy they hand in and in the way so. I mean, I think you might agree that clean thought, I mean, when you get something to review, right? Clean thought expresses somehow also in clean copy, I think, in one way or the other. And
yeah.
I don't want to get Stalinist about it. I can also really bitch a lot about typography and all that. And that's fine, but that's not what I intend to do here. I think focusing on classical typographical rules, it's easier for the eye if you have shorter lines, if you have paragraph breaks, if you respect white space in a clever way. So if you basically use the white space in the sense that it helps the eye to grasp what's going on within a figure or on a page. This has at first nothing to do with science, and I can only apologize to the people who tune in for the science and now they get lectured on white space. But I do think on a deeper level that those things are related. And when it comes to those old papers, I think that's maybe what you also refer to, what I post sometimes on Twitter. I'm also very nostalgic, of course. I'm also thinking of days, of the better days days of scientific publishing, which were probably not better days. They must have been awful, honestly. But I still, so when you had to hand in everything by mail and had to wait for proofs, and then it must have been awful in a way. But I do think that in the technical limitations of a well set typeset manuscript lies a lot of beauty, you know. So it was partly because it was left to professionals. The manuscripts were typeset by professionals. They knew how to, you know, they knew the difference between an N dash and a hyphen. They just did. And so nowadays everybody is a typesetter, and that's rather for worse. And so I think professional, so maybe that's a lesson that's in there, that it does cost money to get good typesetting. I can totally understand if people are upset about Elsevier or the big companies sort of pressing a lot of money from them and then not doing a great job on the typesetting. But I'm very, very willing to pay a lot of money for good typesetting and for good copy editing in that sense. And that's why I'm also clashing sometimes with people in the open science movement who just want to do away with all kinds of journals or with any of that. I do think there is value in professional presentation of science. And I don't think that every scientist, including me, should think like, oh, I can do that myself. I can do a nice manuscript. Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, most no, based on my reviewing experience. Yeah. I think what stings with, you know, the publishing companies is when they charge so much and then they don't do a good job, you know?
Exactly. Yeah, I agree.
If you see it get done well, then I think you see a value there. Are there any journals that you think have a particularly good layout that you like these days? That just kind of give you pleasure to look
still,
at the papers?
They don't pay me, but I do think that Cell Press is still looking great. I mean, they're going full on 90s. If you look up it's a graphics design company called Experimental Jet Set. They're from Amsterdam and they only work in Helvetica. And this is a bold move. I mean, just using Helvetica, but it's a way of restricting yourself. And CellPress, funnily enough, is doing that also. So you must imagine my dismay when Christoph and I finally had this TIX paper out, and ours was the one issue in Trends in Cognitive Sciences that is typeset in a different font, because for whatever reason they changed, for technical problems at CellPress, they changed to a different template essentially for a few issues, and ours was in there. So
that must have been devastating for you.
Yeah, this is devastating. But generally, I think their papers do look pretty great. For one, they're doing a good job in typesetting, and see, they are respecting the white space. And I think CellPress is good. It's also interesting what the Nature journals actually did last year or something. They, particularly Nature itself, they went totally old school. They stripped away all the colors and it was very black and white all
of
a sudden.
Did you like that?
I did like that, yeah, but that's just me probably.
Yeah, no, you have a minimalist kind of aesthetic.
Yeah, that's also true. But that's, that's the way I am.
Have you seen the Neurobiology of Language journal layout?
I'm not fully aware of the current layout of the print. I was following the phase when the journal was really set up, but now that the articles, I think it's only now that the articles keep coming out, right? The fully typeset articles. No, I should check that out.
I won't get you to comment on it if you haven't already formed an opinion on it. It has like a very nice greeny blue color that's used that I kind of like, but there's many other aspects that give me pause, and I'm sure we'll give you pause too.
I remember though complimenting the people behind the journal immediately on the logo when that came out. So I thought there was some attention to detail in there, but I haven't seen the full.
Yeah, there's some controversial choices that will probably not be attended to by any of the readership. But anyway, it's a great journal.
It is.
I'm glad
we have it.
Yeah, not meaning to critique the journal. Okay, so last thing. So you're an editor at Journal of Neuroscience. Can you kind of just share a bit about like what that's been like, what that experience has been like?
It's been great. I mean, I've been doing it for about 2 years now, 2019 and 20. Basically, have been the years that I've been fully involved as a so-called reviewing editor, or what at other journals would be called handling editor, action editor, and it's a great experience. I should say that we're taking really a lot of work goes into the papers that don't make it into peer review, I should say, which is always devastating for an author. But it's at particularly at JNeuro, it's met with great care. It involves at least three people, so at least three editors are entering a comparably detailed discussion about papers. And so that's a lot of work, but it also means that you learn a lot, because like other editors might drag me into these discussions basically. So they've been assigned a paper, but they want to suggest it basically for editorial reject. And then they're making a case for editorial reject. And the other colleagues are then sometimes also playing a bit the devil's advocate and saying, yeah, but if it would have landed on my desk for these and these reasons, always quite technical already, we're not doing this. And so this has been quite joyful experience and actually quite very instructive, of course. So I learned a lot, and you see really the breadth of the field. I mean, I'm mostly seeing auditory, EEG, language work, fMRI work here and there, but often everything with a bit of a language twist. So of course I don't see everything, but what I see and working with the different senior editors and the different styles they're having. So I consider it a great learning experience, honestly.
That's really cool. Are you going to be doing that for a while? Is that like a term, or is it
there's kind of a 3-year term thing? So I might be doing it. I'm ending that 3-year term, and then there's sometimes an extension for another 3 years. So I might be doing it for a few more years. Yeah.
That's great. Cool. Okay. Well, thank you so much for your time. It's been really good talking with you. I hope we get a chance to catch up in person and have a beer again before too long.
Yeah, when this pandemic is over someday.
I just want to travel to every conference. Like, I want to go to every conference. Yeah, I want to, you know,
I'm also
random hotels and, you know, eat at random restaurants like for the rest of my life. I just didn't realize that I'm not quite as much of an introvert as I thought that I was.
Just to say it in the words of Snoop Dogg, as he sat in his car and listened to Frozen, we will be out soon.
We will. All right. Well, take care, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thank you, Stephen. Thanks for having me. Bye-bye.
Bye. Okay, well, that's it for episode 4. Please subscribe to the podcast on your favorite podcast app, and if you have time, rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts. If you'd like to learn more about Jonas's work, I've linked his lab website and the paper we discussed on the podcast website, which is langneuroscience.org/podcast. I'd like to thank Sam Harvey for assistance with audio engineering and Lutton A. Bullock for editing the transcript of this episode. I'd be grateful for any feedback. You can reach me at smwilsonau@gmail.com or smwilsonau on Twitter. And thanks everyone for listening. See you next time.